So, I wanted to, one of the, I mentioned one of the benefits of giving this year and having no curriculum is I can just at whatever point I want to jump out of order and go back to something that I want to add in. So I actually saw earlier today something that I thought was a good sustel, a good connection to one of the things we discussed earlier in the bracha. But basically, that we discussed the connection between, earlier in the bracha, it says, Hashiva Shoftenu Kevar Yishona, return our judges as they were originally. And then it says, Vahaser Mimenu Yagon Va'anacha, and remove from us suffering and anguish, something along those lines. But basically, there's this segue from return our judges and remove from us suffering and anguish. So we discussed a couple ideas of the connection between those two things, the lead-in from one to the other. I saw earlier today a Ramban that I thought actually would be a good another idea for exactly the connection between those two things. The Ramban writes, he's talking about Edim Zomimim, and he's discussing the halacha, very enigmatic halacha about Edim Zomimim, which is that Edim Zomimim is that if two people testify about someone that he did something, and then two witnesses come afterwards and say, those witnesses were with us. They didn't see, I don't know what happened with Bob, who they talked about, but they don't know what happened with Bob either, because they were with us. So that's called Edim Zomimim. They're
questioning their honesty, or they're saying, we saw something different.
No, so they're specifically not saying we saw something different. They're saying, if Reuben and Shimon say, Bob killed Joe, and Levi and Yehuda say, we were there and we saw Bob didn't kill Joe. That's called Hakasha, two witnesses who refute each other, and basically we just ignore them altogether, because it's Trey the Trey, it's two versus two, we aren't right, and we all different kinds of rules, complications about that, but the case of Zomimim is specifically not that, is where Reuben and Shimon saw, we saw Bob kill Joe, and then Levi and Yehuda say, Imanoi Yisim, they say, you did not see Bob kill Joe, because you were with us. You have no way of knowing what happened there. You weren't there. They're saying, I don't know what happened there either, but you certainly don't know what happened there because you were with us. So that's saying, that's called Edim Zomimim. And there's a lot of discussion about exactly why Edim Zomimim, why the second pair is believed over the first. Not going to get into that. It's totally getting off topic. But the Ramban is discussing this enigmatic halakha, which is as follows. Let's say Reuven and Shimon, the case we talked about, before Bob was executed for having killed Joe, the Edim Zomimim, the Edim come along and are Zomim, Mizamim, Reuven and Shimon. They testify that they were with us. So Reuven and Shimon are put to death. What they tried to do to Bob is done to them. However, let's say that Bob was already put to death, and then Levi and Yehuda come along and say they don't know what they're talking about. They're with us. We say, it says that the Torah says that you do what they tried to do to the victim, and not what they did to the victim. If the judgment was already executed, then you do not punish them with the punishment that they ended up having executed against the victim. Right? Very enigmatic halakha.
Really, really fast and lying. Beware.
So basically, a very enigmatic halakha. If they tried to have this punishment carried out against Bob, and they failed because they were caught, then they are punished by Beis Din. And if they succeeded in getting it done against Bob, then they don't get punished in Beis Din. So the Ramban is explaining this halakha, and the Ramban is basically, not going to go through all the nuances of the Ramban says, but the Ramban basically says, this is the part of the judgment of Shemayim being applied to Bob. If God wanted Bob to die, so then he won't have those witnesses be stopped. If God doesn't want Bob to die, so then he will allow for Reuven and Shimon to be caught before Bob is executed. And so he says, if they basically, just to dumb it down, the Ramban is much more nuanced than this, but this isn't my point, so I'm just going to dumb it down for a moment. If Reuven and Shimon got away with what they wanted to do, it is some level of indication that din that was carried out was what God wanted to happen, and therefore we're not going to punish Reuben and Shimon for it, because they were being used as the vehicle to carry out the din Shemayim here. So the Ramban, in the course of explaining his justification for making these statements, one of the things that he says is that Hashem would not allow. Oh, shalo yitain Hashem hashoftim hatzadikim omdim lefanav lishbok dam naki. That Hashem would not allow righteous judges to spill innocent blood. Ki hamishpat elokim hu. Because judgment is carried out by God. Judgment is reserved for God. Ubekarev elokim yishbot. And judgment is carried out in the presence of God, or with God's participation. Vihine calls them Myla Gadola Beshifte Yisrael. Beshifte Yisrael. This is a great Myla, a great level of the judges of Yisrael. There's a promise that God is putting His approbation on what they do. The imahem b'davar mishpat, and He is with them in judgment. And he goes on to explain that. But basically, the basic point of the Ramban says that judges who are truly righteous judges, God will not allow them to carry out a judgment which is false, which is not meant to be executed, right? So, when you take that idea, I think that could also be used to explain this segue, this lead-in in the bracha, that return to us our shoftim kivarishuna, return to us our judges as of old, in the days when we had righteous judges. And if we have righteous judges, then righteous judges will never carry out a false din. One of the you know, one thing is when the din is wrong. So that's one level of frustration, is when, you know, the judges, they didn't know the law appropriately, and there's a mess up, whatever it is. But what would be infinitely more frustrating is if you know that you are right, and you know, Reuven and Shimon come and testify that you borrowed $1,000 from Bob, right? Bob's our man tonight.
You know, right? That you're right, and they're
you
right.
Know you Bob didn't borrow. Let's say yes, right? You know that you did not borrow $1,000 from
there's
Bob.
No room. My question is, there's no room for altering interpretations. We saw it like this. There's an MS. It's
right,
like, I paid the $1,000 or I didn't.
Well, not even I paid, right? Reuven and Shimon come and say, you borrowed $1,000 from Bob, right? You know that you did not borrow $1,000 from Bob. How do you know? Because you are you. Right? There's no questioning whether, right? You know that these witnesses are false witnesses who are making it up. Maybe Bob hired them. Maybe they just don't like you. Whatever it is. But you know 100% absolutely sure this isn't a question of interpretation. You know 100% that you never met Bob in your life. And you never borrowed $1,000 from Bob. And you know that this is a setup.
What about the other you? The other you that says, we saw that you didn't borrow the money. Can you do the you with that also? You're saying the you. You're this person who knows what actually happened.
You are the victim.
Right, but can you apply that same logic of saying you narrating the other side of the equation, saying, I know what I saw. You might know what you saw, but I know what I saw too.
Yeah, but
is there always an M to it?
You could have a case where two people saw things differently, but we're not talking about that. We're talking about where two witnesses come and they're false witnesses. And how do you know they're false witnesses? Because you're the victim. You know you're innocent.
Do they think they're false witnesses?
It doesn't matter. Let's say yes.
Why does it not matter?
Let's say yes. It doesn't matter, because the point is not the particulars of a case of Beis Din. I'm just trying to give the concept here. But let's say for somebody who says yes, right?
Okay.
They came over to you before the court case and they said, we're going to get you, sucker, right? And then they come into Beis Din and they say, he borrowed $1,000. And you know it's not true, and you know that they know it's not true, but Beis Din doesn't know any of this.
Right.
They can't believe you, because you're a party to this case, you get right? So you know that you're right. But Beis Din has to carry out the din as the way it goes. What's infinitely more frustrating is not just to know that the din is not just, you know, that, you know, mistakes happen, but to know 100% that you are right and you are being victimized. That's the greatest source of anguish in judgment.
And it's so, you know, there's modern day wrongful convictions all the time.
All the time. And so the return of, so what is it? The return of Shoftinu Kivarishona, the return of judges who are guaranteed to fight to not make a mistake, because they have God's promise that you will not be fooled by false witnesses. So that will lead to the removal of Yagon V'Anacha, because that will lead to, there is no such thing as a victim anymore. At least a victim through manipulating the court cases. The return of the Shoftim will remove that there will not be such a thing as Ishnati Yarshiyun, as prosecuting, what's the word I'm looking for, as finding guilty the person who's innocent, that will be eradicated by the reestablishment of judges who are at such a level that they merit this divine assistance to have protection from being fooled.
So let's say that in this, let's go back to the same case where you're sitting there and these two witnesses that you know are false, you know they know they're false, but we do have this situation where we have real judges.
Yeah.
As in the old times that had, you know,
yeah,
like they really knew MS. And so in that case, you would know that they're lying, and you would know that you're right and they're wrong, but you'd be okay with that because you probably knew in the back of your head that, like, you kind of, like, sniped $1,000 from somebody else at some other point, and so you're like, I had this coming? Is that what you'd get? You would just have that confidence that you would know? Like,
I assume that there's a historical precedent of a true based in.
Well,
is there such a concept in our past? I know when she comes to be true. There's such a thing, it's not just an ideal future hypothetical. This actually was
right, yeah.
During the Beis HaMikdash, there were...
It might have been during the Beis HaMikdash, but at the very least it was during the time of Moshe Rabbeinu, which is what the Midrash, there's a Midrash which says this bracha, these words of Shiva Shoftenu Kevar Yishona, are a paraphrase of a pasuk, which says, the Ashiv Shoftayich Kevar Yishona, right? The Hashem promises, I shall return your judges as at first. So modeled off of that is the prayer took that as the basis, the model of creating the prayer. So and the Medrash says, so what's Shovtayach Kevar Yishona is Moshe and Aaron, and what's Yoatzayach Kevar Tchila is David and Shlomo, I think is the way it says it. But either way, so there was such a thing as, you know, the court of Moshe and Aaron was a court where, you know, they never made a mistake. They had that divine assurance. But just to get back to your case, I think, I could be incorrect about this, but the way I understood the Ramban is he's not saying that it'll all work out in the end and you'll just know that, that you know, whatever happens is for the best. I believe what he's saying is that God will make sure that the judges figure it out before they get away with it. I believe what the Ramban is saying is that, you know, in the process of interrogating these judges, these witnesses, they'll figure it out, or other, they'll trip themselves up, or other witnesses will come in and tell them and you know, deny them and contradict their story, or however it will happen, that God will make sure that they don't get away with it. But if I the way I understand what the Ramban is saying, I believe what he's saying is not just that you'll know that whatever the judges say, even if you know that these witnesses are lying, you know that it's all fair in the end. I think he's saying going even further than that. I think he's saying that God will make sure that they don't get away with it.
I think that makes more sense, because I think we all intuitively know that, I mean, the modern term for it is just like karma, right? Like one time I got a ticket in high school for going, like, it was not fair, right? But like the previous night I was like doubling the speed limit, so it was like, okay, right? Like, you know, so we have that sense in our broader, like, zoomed out, but it makes a lot
more
sense. It makes more sense for that to be the case in the immediate sense, that the judges will actually figure it out in this case and find MS just in this case in a vacuum.
Right. And then
that in and of itself will reinforce Basedin, because then those witnesses will go, wow, like, this Basedin thing is really real. Like, I'm not coming back again unless I know. Like,
that's like a side benefit. I think the primary point of the Ramban is that these judges, as representatives of God, will get things right. If you are, you know, the Karevel Kim Yishboth, if you're judging with, you know, God is part of the is part of the group here, so then you're guaranteed God's not going to mess things up. So that I think that's really the concept. All right, I want to get back to yes.
To some extent, we're saying God is not messing with things because whatever the ultimate decision is,
That's true at all times. The Gemara says that after the time that Sanhedrin was abolished or ceased to function, so it says that arba misos batlu din arba misos lo batlu, that the application of the death penalty was nullified, but the incurrence of a death penalty, the deserving of a death penalty was not nullified. And the Gemara gives several examples of what would happen to a person who had done, you know, this person did a certain thing and really should have gotten the death penalty. God will arrange it that, you know, they get exactly what they deserve. And the Gemara has a case. It says that you got three people, Shalosha and Nizdamnu Lepundikiyata, the three people who end up, it's arranged that they end up at the same inn. One of them is climbing up a ladder and falls down, and he falls down on another guy and kills him, and there's a different story. They says that there's somebody who was high of Gullus. That's a different story. I'm sorry, I'm mixing two things up. The other story is that that says that you have three people come to an inn. One of them loses his wallet. The other one finds it, and escaping me all the details of the Gemara. Basically, the Gemara says what happened, that this guy had stolen money from this guy, and this guy owed money to this guy. So this one lost his wallet, and this one found it, and then this one was accused of stealing it and had to pay him. And the Gemara has a whole thing of how it works out, that everybody got what they deserved. But God will work it out that everyone gets what they deserved. And not only that, but every judgment in every person's life is backed up with the full confidence of Din Shamayim, which is that God has, you know, a balance that he's keeping, and everything will be made good in the next world, right? You'll have, if in the event that, you know, things didn't play out exactly according to Din, in this world, things will be balanced in the next world. But the added level of the guarantee of righteous judges is they will get things right even in this world. They will get things right exactly as it's supposed to be in every din that they execute. Alright, so getting back to what we were up to, so we'll see how much we get through. I don't think we're going to get through everything. But we were discussing the last words of the bracha, or right before the chasima, right before the concluding line. Tzadkenu b'mishpat is what we discussed at length last week. I just wanted to mention one more small point regarding that, and then we will move on to the chasima of the bracha. The Ya'aros Devash, or Jonas and Eibschitz, writes that the Iker focus, the primary focus of this bracha as a whole, that is the return of the Sanhedrin, which we talked about at length in our introduction to this bracha about the role of Sanhedrin and the central significance and how that bears out in this bracha. Not going to go back to that, but the primary focus of this bracha is the return of the Sanhedrin, who provide clear and absolute knowledge of and guidance through the Torah Sheba'al Peh. The Sanhedrin, you know, everybody can open a Chumash and read it, but the only ones who can provide absolute knowledge of the Torah through the Torah Sheba'al Peh is the Sanhedrin. And just as an aside, the very consequential significance of that is that the Rambam writes in Pirkei Avos that if you don't have a Torah Sheba'al Peh, the Torah Shebichsav means whatever you want it to mean. The Rambam writes that the reason that Tzadok and Baitus, who wanted to basically, they had misinterpreted the Rebbe, and they wanted to kind of, basically they wanted to go off the derech and start the and reject the Torah, they said, if we deny the Torah Sheba'al Peh, they'll kill us. They'll stone us. If we deny the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, they'll stone us, because the written Torah is, you know, it's, everybody has it, it's very, very well accepted and known, whatever it is. So what will we do? We really want to deny the entire Torah, but we can't come out and say, you know, Moshe was a badai, that he, you know, the whole Torah is false. So what? Badai means a joker, or a fool, someone who's fooling you, right? So what will we do? We'll deny the Torah Sheba'al Peh. We'll say that the Torah Sheba'al Peh is corrupted, it's not really accurate, how can you trust it, maybe there was no such thing as a Torah Sheba'al Peh in the first place. We'll deny the Torah Sheba'al Peh, and once we deny the Torah Sheba'al Peh, so we can say whatever we want, because Shara Perushim Lo Ninalu, the gates of commentary were never closed, and to, if you want to see the truth of that statement, open up, you know, Google Torah thought on this week's Torah portion. Don't write Parsha, but write Torah portion, and see what kinds of nonsense you can pull up on Rabbi Google. And you'll see that the avenues of explaining the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, however you would like to suit whatever needs you have, always possible. What is it that turns the Torah Shebichsav, the written Torah, into a Torah which is binding and livable and has a meaning to it? Is the Torah Shebaal Peh. The Torah Shebaal Peh, which says this is how it's meant to be understood, and this is what this means, and the way in which this is meant to be applied is like this. That's the Torah Shebaal Peh, and I believe that this is the reason that the Rambam, in his list of the Yud Gimel Ikrim, of the 13 principles of faith, so the Rambam has several things which he splits into two principles, even though they are logically, one might be a consequence of the other, there are certain logical overlaps between the two of them, he still splits them into two, because there are things which you need to know, which each of them have to be cognizant of them independently. However, the Rambam lumps into one principle the Torah Shebichsav and the Torah Shebaal Peh. The Rambam puts the authority or the reliability of both the Torah Shebichsav and the Torah Shebaal Peh both into one ikar, both into the eighth principle. The reason, I believe, is that the Rambam has no problem splitting things up if they are two independent ideas, even if they're logically very related. The reason the Rambam puts them together is because these are not two ideas. The Torah Shebichsav and the Torah Shebaal Peh are inseparably linked. You do not have one without the other. You only have a Torah Shebichsav. You don't have half of a Torah if you only have a Torah Shebichsav.
What I always tell people is, read the translation of the Torah. Like, read, like, you know, this week's Parsha. You know, like, it doesn't make any sense.
Would they eat cheeseburgers?
Hmm?
Kalav, Kalev. Would they eat cheeseburgers to prove their point? I mean, they put their money where their mouth is, I'm saying, when they say we're going to deny the Oral Torah.
Yeah, for sure. They actively denied the Oral Torah and did what
they
wanted.
And lived by it.
And lived by it, yeah. That's the famous sect known as the...
How do you know it's not cook a mother its own fat?
Or I go a step further. You don't even have to go that far. I could keep the word halav. So I've got a cow, I got its mother, okay, I won't put them. But this isn't this cow's mother.
Chicken parm,
right?
Let's do it.
There's more than chicken parm. I got two cows. They're just not biologically related, so then they're good, right?
Oh, wow.
Right?
A cow
and a goat, right? Right? But even more than a cow and a goat. Two cows, as long as one's not the other one's mother, right? So Tzadok...
Thanks for taking my example to a rabbinic level.
That's right. Tzadok is the forefather of the sect, the sectarian group known as the Tzadukim.
Right.
The Tzadukim come out of Tzadok. The Tzadukim lived by this philosophy.
They wanted Tzadikim, by the way. Tzadukim. That's interesting.
Yeah, it's ironic. All right. But in any case, so the proper application of the Torah through Torah Shebaal Peh is only through the Sanhedrin. The Sanhedrin are the only ones who had the absolute ability, the absolute clarity of Torah Shebaal Peh, and they have the ability.
Inclusive of Nevi'im.
What?
Inclusive or exclusive of Nevi'im?
Exclusive of Nevi'im. Well, the Sanhedrin existed at the same time as Nevi'im. Right. Some of them were Nevi'im.
The idea of having an exclusive channel to Emes from Hashem. I'm asking.
A Navi
have a separate.
No, a Navi is not allowed. A Navi is not allowed to paskin halacha based on Nevuah.
But they can.
That's
they
part
can
of the halacha.
They just have to be quiet about it.
What?
They could
express. No, they could share their opinion as a chacham.
Uh-huh.
As a Torah scholar, that's what they say. When Eliyahu will come back. When Eliyahu Navi comes, it says that Eliyahu will the word teku. One explanation, the word teku, which is whenever the Gemara has an unanswered question, has a whole, you know, two possibilities, and it says teku, which Archkol, I think, translates as let the matter stand.
I love it when we get to that.
However, one of the explanations brought down in the commentary is that teku is Rosh Tevos, stands for Tishbi Yitaret Kushyasenu V'Ubrayasenu. That Tishbi, Eliyahu HaTishbi, Eliyahu will... will resolve. As I say, Eliyahu HaTishbi.
Uh-huh.
Right.
Uh-huh.
So Eliyahu will answer, will resolve our questions and our problem and our difficulties and our questions. Right. So the question is asked by commentaries. How can Eliyahu do that? Eliyahu is a Navi. Lo Bashamayimi. The Torah is not in heaven. A Navi is not allowed to resolve questions based on his prophetic knowledge. So one of the answers given, a lot of different different ideas. But one answer given is that Eliyahu HaNavi is going to be able to answer the questions as a Chacham, because Eliyahu HaNavi was on Sanhedrin. He had Smicha. And therefore...
Is he special, or were there other Nevi'im among the Sanhedrin?
No, the Anshei Knesset Gedolah had plenty of Nevi'im among them.
Uh-huh. But when they answered, when they passed
in the Shaila, they're always, right, always from their knowledge of Torah, not their Nevu'ah.
So they really
right?
could wear two different hats, so to speak.
Yes.
Were you even sure on this, that, one of the key elements of the Nevi'im of Judaism is that they were professional Nevi'im. They weren't like some guy who was like, I got it. Some guy who can't read. Who was like,
exclusively Nevi'im.
I have mentioned this before, right? That a Nevi, I don't remember where, maybe I said it at a Shabbos table, I don't remember, but in other religions you might have an illiterate fellow walking around along the road to Damascus, not to mention any names, and suddenly he's struck with the Holy Spirit that God happens upon him and speaks to him, right? There's no such thing as that in Judaism. In Judaism, Avraham Avinu spends 45 years between the time that he realizes that God exists until the time that working on himself, perfecting himself before the time that God speaks to him. A Navi, right, the end of Maseilas Yesharim, after you go through all the steps of Zahiros and Nikias and Zahiros and Zrizus and everything else, and eventually you get to Tara and then to Kedusha and then to Ruach HaKodesh, and after Ruach HaKodesh is Nevuah. You don't need it. Not some guy bumbling along the street and is like, Bob, whoa, who said that? Bob, it's God talking. That doesn't happen in Judaism. The right? thing is that. Exactly. Right? So we're really picking on Bob tonight. But
seriously, killing he happened upon.
Exactly. But in any case,
why God's calling on him.
But in Judaism, there's no such thing as that. A Navi is always someone who has reached certain threshold of personal perfection. Now, it doesn't have to be that the Navi is the greatest Chacham in the world. It might be that one of the best avenues in one of the versions of the Brisa of Rav Pinchas ben Yair, which Maseilas Yesharim is modeled off of, actually says Torah may be lidei Zahiris. That Torah brings to Zahiris. That the first step is Torah. Torah brings you to the first level, and then from there progresses on to eventually Ruach HaKodesh and Nevuah. But in any case, we are getting rather far afield here.
Because this was like a quarters off session with Rabbi Gershenfeld, where he was saying that there are, you know, some yeshivas who say you should just learn Musar. You don't have to learn Torah, but there's the implication that, okay, you start with Torah and then you get to the Zeros.
Right. Well, you know, there's a famous tension between two things, which is that we say Derech Eretz Kadmah LaTorah, but at the same time we say that Torah refines a person, so the whole thing of, you know, how does that start? Nefesh HaChayim, and okay, too many, alright, fine. In any case, so that's one facet that Rionis Ivshitz and Yaros Devash points out. And the other thing that he says is that the Shoftim have the ability, the Sanhedrin has the ability to be Malka and Manish. They have the ability to give corporal punishment and capital punishment as needed, but that they have the ability to execute judgment and punishment, and through the onesh, through the punishment, you become pater from the onesh shemayim, from the heaven, through the human punishment, you become exempted from the heavenly punishment. If the din is carried out by Beis Din, so that exempts you from the associated heavenly punishment which would have been necessary otherwise. And says the Taras Devash, that's one aspect of Tzadkenu Bamishpat, is that through Mishpat, through the Shoftim, through the execution of judgment through the Shoftim, our Mishpat is Tzedek, is Nitzdak, is vindicated, because it's already been taken care of through the Shoftim. That's one element of Tzadkenu Bamishpat. The other thing, and he doesn't directly tie this back into the word Tzadkenu Bamishpat, but the other idea that he mentions is that we should daven for appropriate Dayanim, that we should daven for judges who are appropriate, who are kosher, who are legitimate, and the judges can, and they then will be able to guide us in the right way. If we have the appropriate shoftim, then they will be able to guide us in the right way. And he doesn't tie this back into Tzadkenu B'Mishpat, but I think the same idea, that if you have Sanhedrin, those who have the absolute clarity in the understanding of Torah Shebaal Peh, the application of Torah, exactly how one is meant to live the Torah, if those are the people guiding you, then Mimeila, then an automatic result of that will be Tzadkenu B'Mishpat, that you will end up being vindicated in judgment, because if you have that kind of leadership, if you have that kind of role model, so of course you're going to live your life according to the to a way in which there's nothing that can be held against you. You're going to be, of course, you're going to live your life in a way in which you're going to come out vindicated in judgment. You will have done it. If you have that kind of leadership and that kind of guidance, so you're going to live your life in a way in which you're doing almost everything, if not everything, right. Your occasional slip up and whatever it is. But if we could have the Sanhedrin leading us, if we could have leadership of that caliber, so then Tzadkenu B'Mishpat is going to be because you deserve it. You're gonna live that kind of life, and therefore that the reinstitution of Sanhedrin leads to Tzadkenu B'Mishpat, leads to coming out Nitzdak, coming out the Tzadik B'Mishpat, coming out justified, vindicated in judgment, because there won't be anything to find wrong, to any fault to find.
So will the Sanhedrin inspire themselves out of necessity?
What do you mean?
If the Sanhedrin inspire everybody to what you just said,
yeah,
right, to that level of understanding and that level of doing the right thing,
yeah,
won't that negate the need for the Sanhedrin anyway?
Particularly
in times of Mashiach, when everything is supposed to be.
No, it's like why we have a death penalty and it almost never gets used, right? It's just the fact that it's there is what reinforces it and makes it effective.
I mean, the more basic answer is that even if everyone is doing good, there will still be those who are
misunderstandings.
There were
better than everyone else.
There
will still be not focusing about things. Still have people, you know, have two different ideas of, see things from their own prison. But also, there will always be, even if everyone is on a very high level, there will always be those who are on a higher level, and that will be necessary always to have those role models to bring everyone else up, and not necessarily that you'll reach the point where everyone is on that level.
So it seems then that with this bracha, and then there's more to it, I think, but a big chunk of it is davening for Gula.
So
we already did.
Well, so
in Shmur Esrei, right?
Yes and no. We discussed in some of the previous brachos that starting from, in a certain sense, starting from Baruch Aleinu, but really starting from Tekah B'Shofar, is all of the brachos have to do with Geula. Starting from Tekah B'Shofar onwards, all of them are different aspects of Geula. And we discussed that the part of Geula that we daven for already, Tekah B'Shofar, is really only the very first step of Geula. Geula is not the return to Eretz Yisrael. People who say we have autonomous control of Eretz Yisrael, now we have Geula, are absolutely mistaken.
Definitely.
Right? That's step one of Geula is, and really...
We can't control ourselves.
We discussed then that the real idea there is the recreation of the unity of Klal Yisrael.
Yeah.
Step one of Geula is reunifying Klal Yisrael, and part of that process, or maybe the manifestation of that process, is the return to Eretz Yisrael. I didn't mention it at the time. I saw it afterwards, and I didn't go that far back to mention it. But I saw the Maharal in Netzach Yisrael, and he says it again in Nesiv Ha. Tzedakah says that Achdus of that in Netzach Yisrael, he says Pirut, Golus is Pirut, Golus, exile is fragmentation. He says those two concepts are synonymous. The opposite of fragmentation is Geula, and the Maharal writes in Nesiv Ha Tzedakah, writes that Eretz Yisrael represents Achdus of Klal Yisrael, is represented through Eretz Yisrael. That's the makom, that is the place of Achdus, that true Achdus of Klal Yisrael is only achieved in Eretz Yisrael. Now, we discussed that at length back then, but just that's really exactly the principle that we were talking about, back then. But basically, so we're gonna stop here.
A question for later on the subject.
Yes.
It's not directly related to this, but we do have Geula and we're all unified. I think that the obvious thing is like, all right, like, Reformed Jews will stop arguing with Orthodox Jews about what it means to interpret different things and how it applies to today. Those things will become clear. But when you talk about different Hasidim, for example, and the things that they disagree on, will they
still disagree?
Okay.
But they'll understand that everybody has a valid point. We talked about this also, that the Gemara says, the Pasuk says, Bayomahu, Hine Elokeinu Zekavinu Lo, that it says that that they will say, this is our God who we've been waiting for. The Medrash says that that tzaddikim will be sitting in a circle, and they will all point to the middle and say that this is our God, right? They'll all be at a different point of the circle. And you know what? The two people who are on opposite sides of the diameter of that circle will be pointing in opposite directions. But both of them will be exactly the same distance from HaKadosh Baruch Hu, that there is a spectrum of valid approaches. Now, obviously, there's an even larger spectrum of invalid approaches, but there's a spectrum of valid approaches, of equally valid approaches to have a relationship with God, and not necessarily that, you know, in the time of Mashiach and Geula, that, you know, all of the Sephardim will finally realize that the Ashkenazim had it right and stop eating kitnios, but they'll all realize that each of them had a valid, it will lead to an acceptance of their differences, not an elimination of their differences.
So my colored shirts have a chance.
I don't know about that. I won't go that far. All right, we're going to stop here.